This is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills, and I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. Today I have here with me in the studio Kingston-based movement artist Lena Azalea Dabur and Caro-based noise musician Matt Luzak. I'll read out brief bios for them to start. Lena Azalea Dabur is an interdisciplinary artist and event producer based in New York City and the Hudson Valley. She specializes in multimedia movement performance and dance event creation. Her work has been presented at New York Live Arts, Rose Kill, Glasshouse Project, Rockaway Art Week, The Locker Room, Green Kill, Trans Picos, Groundswell Series, Terrain Exhibitions, and DIY venues across the Northeast. Matt Luzak is a Hudson Valley-based drummer and noise artist. He specializes in tape looping, harsh noise, and free jazz. Matt runs Buddy Fest, an annual noise festival in Cairo, New York, that raises funds for animal charities. He has toured the country performing at shows and festivals such as the International Noise Conference, Midwest Harsh Fest, and End Times. So Lena and Matt have been collaborating for some time now. And I'm going to jump right in by playing audio from a recent performance collaboration of theirs. It's a rather rough audio recording of a show that happened on March 17th at Trans Picos in Queens. But before we listen, I just wanted to ask you to, since the listeners don't have the visual to look at, what they would be seeing on stage if they were there at the show.
Well, first of all, thanks for having us. So this particular performance started with me basically crawling out of a bathroom on all fours with a box full of lights, a transparent box full of lights that also had a Bluetooth microphone inside of it. And I had a Bluetooth microphone in my mouth where I was making kind of strange vocalizations. And do you want to describe your role in this?
All right, so also there's a table with a contact microphone connected to it that at certain points during the performance, Lena's dragging that around and I'm processing that sound. So mostly I'm kind of off to the side a bit in this performance, and the visual element is mostly on Lena's performance. But I think that's about it. I think depending on where the clip is from, Lena's either going to be crawling with a box of lights or dragging the table around and doing the various types of performing with the table.
Yeah, so this clip is from the part of the performance in which she's interacting with the table. So one thing I really like about what the audio from your performances does is it channels something from what's happening visually, I think, very strongly. And I mean, because these mics are attached to physical objects and attached to your body, the sounds feel, they have this tactility to them. And there's also this three-dimensionality to the sound because there's so much starting and stopping that they're almost like these discrete sound objects that, you know, there's like, you can pick one up and hold it.
I really appreciate that observation, 'cause I'm someone that comes from a very classical dance background where I was very much supposed to be seen and not heard, and, you know, physically made to be smaller, both like in a personality and literally my body was supposed to be smaller than it was. And so I feel like part of this collaboration that's so kind of positive for me is that those movements can actually be really, really loud. Instead of feeling like I have to, you know, breathe softer, I'm amplifying my breathing.
Yeah, I think that because in order to hear the sounds that a body is making, you have to be really close to the body. There's something very intimate about being able to hear those sounds. Yeah, because you can see people from a distance, but you can't like hear their mouths and breathing. And
yeah, I feel like this project has a weird combination of intimacy and non-intimacy, because I work a lot in the dark and I really don't like to be seen sometimes. But then we're, you know, yeah, it has this quality to it that is very intimate with the breathing. And
yeah, I think with amplifying the breathing, it would be, if I just produced it to be loud the entire time, it wouldn't kind of be giving the space that we're trying to give each other, you know. It's more like just trying to amplify those little sounds, but instead of making it be like a big wall of sound, which I do a lot, giving those large spaces and timing that out is the thing that I think is like especially unique about what we've developed out of the project.
Yeah, what you said about the difference between what you're doing with sound here and the kind of effect when you're generating this wall of sound, I think at a noise show, there's this way in which the loudness and the fact that the noise will just fill the space, you just get caught up and carried away. And I feel like the noise fills the space to such a degree that it's not really about individual makers or bodies anymore. It's just like people, the whole thing just sort of turns into this sludge. And I really like how the fact that there's this body there in front of the audience generating these sounds, it's like it's much more of an encounter, I guess, rather than an escape. And I love that kind of escape. Like, I love just loud music that sort of takes me somewhere else or elevates me in some strange kind of way. But this kind of it's using those materials, but it's like it's at least giving the illusion, like, this is a body making meaning, or this is a body expressing itself. And yeah, I think that's something that I noticed when I saw you guys perform that I really liked. And I wanted to ask about those chest and throat sounds specifically, the breathing, the groaning, the gasping. These are all nonverbal sounds. It's like, you know, before language, before words come in. And Matt, in watching some of your solo performances, you do amplification and distortion of those same kinds of vocalization. And so I wanted to ask you both, like, what draws you to that kind of vocalization as performance material?
I think for me, you know, going back to having this dance training, I was told for so many years, you know, to literally make my breath quiet. Like, when you're doing, like, classical ballet, they literally tell you, we shouldn't hear your breathing. We shouldn't even see it. And, you know, I feel like my journey kind of, like, unraveling all of that training, part of it has, I think, brought me to this kind of, like, raw vocalization work. I guess also, like, as a movement artist, I've never really identified with words as my way to really express myself, at least like in a live setting. I do like to write, but this idea of like using my voice in this kind of like expressive, like flow state way that doesn't use language just feels really intuitive.
Yeah, it's very similar for me also. I have experienced singing in bands when I was younger. And the goal there is to sound really good and cool. I don't know if I never really tried that with my experimental work, but it feels more vulnerable and just like not cool. It's like an embarrassing thing to exhibit. And so I like, it's the same in the noise scene. There's a lot of people who will do screaming or different types of voices, but they still make it sound really cool and good, and they look very aggressive and scary. And I always liked mine to kind of be almost like goofy or silly, or just as long as like it's expressing like a genuine thing. And I sometimes feel like the aggressive kind of screaming is not genuine. It's an act. It's the same emotion that you do every time.
Yeah, thinking about that kind of vulnerability or exposure, when I was, you know, in the audience at your performance and re-watching or watching video of some of your other performances, the expression spilling your guts came to my mind because you have Lena using these technological tools to eject sounds from her mouth and throat and amplify them. And in many of the performances, there's this cathartic moment when you have this box of LED lights and you dump them all over the floor. And it's like there's this symbolic and also actual like pushing out of the insides of things, which is the literal definition of the word expression. And so this is another question for the both of you. How do you view the role of these technological objects? Do you see them as conduits for expression or as prosthetics?
I think for me, they feel like extensions. Like I just want to maximize myself. I just want to expand myself as much as I can and extend like the energetic imprint I can have.
I look at them as just tools, I guess, but in the same way, like it is the selection of the tool is part of the process, like part of the expression, you know, in the piece. So if I were for this work, The transmitter microphones make the most sense. The contact microphone on the table makes the most sense. I have a ton of other things that we could be using, but I think what seems the most appropriate. So there's no pedals. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I would, you know, in previous work, I would use effects or a keyboard or a sampler or something, and none of that's used. It's really just feedback and tapes because I like to use as little as possible and then try to fill that with what we're doing. But for me, you know, like the lights and everything, it's all like symbolic. Doing tape loops to me has always been like a symbolic thing, and then I do mixer feedback loop in that same setup, so it's all looping and it's all meant to me to be like a part of the expression.
If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin, and here in the studio with me today are the Kingston-based movement artist, Lena Azalea Dabur, and the Caro-based noise musician, Matt Luzak. Yeah, so I feel like one thing we've sort of been talking about is the question of like allowing oneself to do something ugly. And in general, I notice that there's this sort of anti-aesthetic. And what I mean is that you have the LED lights in this big plastic bin that looks like it could be from Dollar General. And you're sort of, you're interacting with this cheap plastic folding table. And props are obviously key to the performances. So, of course, you're thinking carefully about what you have on stage with you. So I just wanted to ask about that choice. Is there something about the look of nondescript utilitarian objects that appeals to you?
I personally love ugly and bad things. But no, I think it literally is just a utilitarian thing, because I have to beat these props up and use and abuse them. The box gets broken like every other performance. The lights are super cheap and they run out after 2 hours, so I have to constantly buy new ones. The table gets dented. Like, I don't know. We can't
The table was, I just have this metal table that I've performed with a lot. It's very convenient to bring around. And then attaching the contact mic to it, it's like in noise shows, everybody has the tables. Mm-hmm. It's a joke amongst all the artists. And so connecting the contact microphone to it is, to me, like a joke in that way. And then the performance that ends up happening is so much more than that. But the table with the microphone on it was like a added thing. It's a little gimmicky, you know. I don't want to, we probably won't keep doing that. Some of these tools or whatever, it's like such a spectacle. It makes too much of a attention for the table. And we don't want to be the table band.
Or the light band. I mean, I've been working with these lights for so long, and I'm kind of at the end of the road with them. But I feel like I don't know. I mean, I really like beautiful, expensive things too, but I feel like for this type of show that we've been doing, it's about what will let us be the most expressive that we can be. And if I had some really expensive glass box that I'm afraid to throw around, we just wouldn't be able to make the same kind of performance.
Yeah, I think the aesthetic, or at least the impression of a lack of aesthetic, even though there's always going to be an aesthetic because you're making choices. In the context of this kind of performance, it's very powerful, especially with the lights, because the lights, there's like this elemental presence that you're sort of conjuring with the lights. And I think that the contrast between that and the cheap plastic bin is... I liked that a lot, or I found it beautiful. Yeah. And I guess I wanted to ask you, in general, as artists and in this kind of work, how you conceive of beauty, especially in light of the fact that the notion of harsh noise suggests a kind of anti-beauty.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's just like everybody has their own personal relationship with whatever they think is beautiful. and you know, I've always been a fan of like heavy metal or that type of art, and it is beautiful. And so like, it's not all that we are, you know, but I think it is beautiful.
Yeah, we were talking, I think, at least for me, I don't intellectualize a lot of the work I make. It feels like intuitive, or I'm trying to channel something. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, something I like about working with Matt is that he is this very particularly interesting mix of like discomfort and disturbing, and also like cathartic and almost like spiritual and beautiful. And I don't know, it's interesting though, because the piece I made in January, which was supposed to be in this big theater, just felt like more classically beautiful, versus the work that we do does walk this line between like ugly and uncomfortable and hopefully beautiful as well.
Yeah, when I was thinking about what to ask you, I don't know why I wanted to talk about beauty, but I decided that I did. And it was like, it just became interesting to me to think about, well, what does that mean? I mean, I feel like in our conversation so far, it's catharsis. Yeah, so that's one definition.
Yeah, I feel like something that I see a lot in the noise world is that there's just like a true experience happening. That's something that I keep going back to the classical dance world, but it feels a lot like in classical dance, you're trying to like live up to an ideal. And oftentimes when you're trying to get to that ideal, it's disingenuous for whatever reason, like it's just not in you, or you have to hurt yourself to get there, or it feels hollow. And I feel like I see a lot in noise, people leaning into whatever is actually true in their body. And that's what I try to do in this project too. And yeah, catharsis, like just what feels true to you. I always feel like that's beautiful, because I see a lot of performance art, and that's what I notice, you know, when it feels like someone's actually going through an experience in a genuine way, even if it's, you know, kind of off-putting or ugly, it's often beautiful to me.
Yeah. So one thing that I'm always curious about with work that is this abstract is what's the criteria that artists arrive at to judge whether a piece is successful or not? Because and Matt kind of touched on this already, but if you're in a band playing songs, you want to be singing on key, and you want the drummer's timing to be right, and you want the lyrics to be clever. So I wanted to ask what some of the language that you find yourselves using when you're working out what you liked and didn't like about a performance. Or just how do you find yourself assessing the work?
There's a few different ways. Like for me personally, it's just a feeling. So if I feel like we were connected, and the timing cues were just magically, like we were not planning things, but they were just kind of falling together, like we were really in sync, I feel like that to me personally is the goal, and that makes it a success. And then there's other metric, like how the audience reacts. Sometimes I feel like they might just go totally nuts and it wasn't really something that we were feeling. And then sometimes I feel like it all matches up.
Yeah, I think feeling like we are able to settle in to a performance and not kind of rush through it. But it is such an intangible thing, trying to figure out what went right and what went wrong. And it does feel like something that has no measurements or rhyme or reason to it, just like is out there existing, and we either were there or not. I don't know.
Yeah, because there's not even like a technical error. You could say like, oh, there's no technical errors, because sometimes the technical stuff will go wrong, but the performance will come out great because mm-hmm. of the solutions that we come up with on the spot. And that's just being in the moment. And that's more, I think, what makes it better is if we're together in the moment and being like conscious of each other's performance while we're doing this, it does come out like it's been planned, and like we had it choreographed and like composed, just because we're able to capture these things by being sensitive to our surroundings in that way, which is, it took a lot of practice, many years of improvising and playing with different people to kind of get to a place where that is something that'll happen more often.
Yeah, I guess we should say that we are improvisers. We mm-hmm. don't set material. So every time we perform, it's complete improvisation. And I think that is something anyone who improvises in any medium can relate to. Like sometimes you just get to a place that feels magical, and then sometimes you don't, and it's a little mysterious.
To what extent does the nature and layout of the venue that you're in, or I don't know, the proximity of the audience, affect like how successful you end up thinking the piece is, or has it, you know? I guess there'd be a big difference between performing in an art gallery and performing in a rock club.
Yeah.
I feel like we're always performing 2 inches away from people, which I kind of like.
Yeah, it kind of feels better when the audience is compact and it's like an intimate mm-hmm. environment.
Yeah, and you can kind of feed off people's energies. Or with this project, I've never really done this before, but I kind of get to push people around a little bit. Like I've never sung in a punk band, but this is like my version of it, is I get to like shove people out of the way. It's really fun.
Yeah, so a good size crowd is something that we appreciate. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that like the video that you had, we're at Transpacos and it's a pretty small space and the crowd is around us. And I think that's the best way to see it, to kind of be very close up on what's happening. And I think we really feed off of that energy. Sometimes if I'm playing a noise show and it's in a club like that and they're like, oh yeah, just set your stuff up on the stage, I'm like, I really don't play on the stage that often, so I'll set it up on the floor in front of the stage, and it just feels like having the people being that much closer, they can see what's happening and they get more engaged. And I think that feedback loop is important for me especially, but I think as a group, like, we feed off of that energy of the audience being shocked or whatever it is. It's just like cool to have them having a close-up view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even just on a human level, I think there's something actually healing about just being in the center of a circle of people and they're all just like focusing their energy towards you, and you I don't know.
Yeah.
It feels like primal or something.
It's almost like a separate topic, but I also think like the volume is important in that too. Kind of giving like a proper context for it. It's like going into the movies. The volume's not like a normal volume. It's pretty loud. But not all the time. The volume dynamic is like really important, and I really like it to have like a ton of bass and really be able to kind of drown out all the other sound in the room at certain times. It just adds to the kind of togetherness. Everybody's hearing the same thing. That is like, it's like almost like volume. The speakers are an instrument.
Have you performed this duo on a proper stage at all?
No, we haven't. That would be interesting.
Yeah, I think it would be really different. Although when I saw you two perform, it was everyone was sitting on the floor, so that must have been different. And that was more of like a, yeah, it's a dance space, so that must have felt different than, well, yeah, I don't know, like what kinds of venues have you played at? Has it been a wide range?
I think performing at North Node was nice because it was a clean marley floor, and we're usually on these like dirty disgusting floors where I'm just mopping up everything with my body.
Yeah.
But let's see, we've performed at North Node, which is a dance studio. We performed at the Living Gallery, which is, I don't know, how would you describe the Living Gallery?
It's an art gallery. It's like an empty storefront in a mini mall kind of place in Brooklyn.
But it's not a white cube.
Concrete floor.
Yeah, like, yeah, I've been there. It's like, yeah, it doesn't feel precious.
Yeah.
Trans Pecos is one of those places where it does have a stage and a really good sound system, but I set my table up on the floor and the stage was just empty.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's what we did when we had that opportunity.
Yeah. The last place we performed was at a house venue, which was really fun because we were literally in a living room and people were like sitting on the floor on the couch, and that was fun because it felt a little bit like moshing, like I was kind of like rolling around on people's laps a little bit.
I wanted to ask a bit about the evolution of your collaboration, and I'm wondering if Matt, you were interested in dance before you started working with Lena, and Lena, had you been using these kinds of technologies and sonic distortions in your work before connecting with Matt?
I think it was an interest of mine, and I'd played certain fests in Massachusetts called X Fest, and they would always have dancers involved, and so I had done it a few times, but I never really met anybody that it felt like this is a reason to collaborate. So there were talented people, and I think we did cool things together, but it wasn't really something I thought of doing until I met Lena.
Yeah, I mean, similar for me, I think I saw like one noise artist in college, but I had never been to a noise show until I met Matt, and he took me to a noise fest and it blew my mind. And yeah, and that's what started this journey for me.
Do you feel like your individual approaches to making work separate from each other have somehow been changed by the collaboration?
I feel like I have this type of freedom maybe in my creative process that I didn't have before. I've always been a little bit of a perfectionist, and I feel like, you know, when we work together, when there's, you know, just kind of getting more into experimental music, there is like a messiness or like a just like a free form to it maybe that I hadn't used before.
Were you improvising before?
I would improvise before. Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting because I kind of been organizing my work more. And so I right at the moment I have it divided into separate projects, and each of them are doing recordings and different shows, and it's a lot to keep track of, but Lena does so much organizing, and I think it's kind of rubbed off on me in that way where like turning some of my projects instead of having them be like an element in what I'm doing, it can become its own thing. That's mostly just like taking notes, like the way that Lena does her organizing and curating and everything, I think has like influenced how I work, and it just has helped me get more done. Because we both curate a lot of stuff. I do the Buddy Fest, and Lena does Bad Dance and Momenta. It's a lot of organizing, and I feel like I used to just kind of scribble in a notebook and have things very kind of raw before I would put them out. And now I feel like it's just helping me kind of get a lot more things done instead of them kind of just being like an idea that gets like kind of washed away.
I'm impressed by the fact that you both organize like substantial festivals and performance series and still manage to make your own work on the regular. And I might need to get some advice on that because it doesn't happen that way for me. If you're just tuning in, this is Specific Objects, Talks on Art in the Catskills. I'm your host, Miriam Atkin. And here in the studio with me today are the Kingston-based movement artist, Lena Azalea Dabur, and the Caro-based noise musician, Matt Luzak. So I wanted to shift to talking about your individual bodies of work. Matt, my knowledge of experimental improvisation comes mostly from the free improv and free jazz world, where musicians are using a lot of traditional instruments. And it's only recently that I've developed an appreciation for noise, and it's a fascinating new terrain for me. I wanted to ask if you can talk a bit about the sonic materials you use for improvisation. Do you use a lot of found sounds and other pre-recorded audio? Are you often or always processing sounds that you're hearing during the time of performance, or is it usually some combination of both? And also a part of that could be like if you have a history with traditional instruments. I'm curious about that as well.
Oh, okay. I play drums in a lot of groups doing like kind of free improv. Hmm. It's like free jazz, but it's a little bit more out.
Yeah.
A lot of times there'll be somebody doing like a noise element in that. But that is just a regular drum set, and I don't use a lot of like extended techniques or anything. Mm-hmm. I just kind of play the set with kits or with sticks. But that just as an improvisational exercise or like practice is something that I just always do and continue to do. You know, right now I'm a lot more focused on the noise stuff. It's just like I keep putting out these albums, and then every time I go to do shows, that's really what I'm getting asked to do because of the previous records that I put out. So it just becomes like a cycle, and I end up doing less drumming at the moment. But the tools I use are pretty traditional. Nothing too, like at the moment, nothing's too like affected. It's just the tape machine, a mixer, and a couple of microphones. The sound sources that I'll be looping are what changes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I want it to just be my voice. So a lot of the shows are just my voice being looped live at that show. And other times I just have collections of cassettes of all kinds of music. And I'll sample them in very distorted ways. I'll stretch things out or speed things up and take little tiny sections of things just to turn it into a source for sound. And sometimes I use it in a very literal way. Mm-hmm. Where you can definitely tell what you're listening to, and I'm doing a copyright thing to somebody at the moment. But that kind of stuff, I'll always throw a couple tapes in my gear to have just in case I want to sample Bobby Brown or Yanni or whatever it is. I'll just have a couple things as an option. Sometimes I won't use them, and then sometimes when I do, it just creates like oh, I'm glad I had that. That was like, that worked out really well. And there was a show I did on tour where they were listening to Billie Holiday. just before my set happened, and I recorded my loop of Billie Holiday right in that moment, and then I slowed it down and did a, you know, I did a little like opening piece with what was playing in between the sets right before my set. And I feel like that just as like a site specific, if you want to call it that, just to kind of, the audience definitely caught on to that, or some of them did. And to me, that's like kind of like an interesting way to just improvise. For me, that was like an improv moment. I didn't have that planned at all. See, that's it about the sources. And I've been using less and less effects over the years. I used to have a few effects, like a distortion and a delay, and now there's nothing. It's just tape and gain feedback.
Yeah. And I think the main reason why I've become interested in noise music over the last couple of years is because there are so many great noise shows around the Catskills and Hudson Valley. And I feel like you have a big hand in this. So I wanted to ask about the history of your involvement in the noise scene in this area.
Yeah, when I first got started, I didn't know how to get booked or do, I didn't know where to play this kind of music. I'd been in some bands and things, but as far as performing, I didn't know where to go. So I just found a coffee shop in Poughkeepsie where I used to live and started putting on shows. And I met a lot of the people that I'm still friends with now. And, you know, I would just, anytime somebody messaged me asking for a show, if they were on tour, I would find them a place to play. We would do it at the coffee shop or we'd go to the record store. And then, you know, like, so I just wanted to play at first, and then anytime somebody else wanted to play, I wanted to help them. And then at some point, it was almost like 10 years ago, I got an apartment in New Paltz and just turned it, it's right in the middle of the village, and I turned it into just a DIY place for only really noise shows and improvised kind of music. And that really turned it into something else. I think before that, it was like people knew. They're like, oh, there's a guy in Hudson Valley that can help you out, maybe. This turned into like, you have to go to New Paltz to play the Noise House with the guy and the dog. And that ran for about 6 years. I think that's really what gave me like a presence in that way, as far as like people wanting to play shows with, come to this area to specifically to book a show with me. There's a lot of other people that are booking great shows around here, but this was, it was mostly the house in New Paltz. And, you know, my dog was always there, which was an attraction to people. They really liked that. And, I would do them almost every week. There was over 100 shows in that house. And then since then, you know, I've kind of just kept in touch with people. Like I don't really have a space to put on shows, but I can put people in touch with other people. It gave me a good idea of who's creating stuff, like who locally wants to be playing shows and who else is booking, who in Philly is, or Baltimore is kind of traveling a lot. So if I want to go there, you know, this like this network just expanded from doing that. And it's really a snowball effect that kind of happened. Now I don't really do it as much. I just only do Buddy Fest once a year. And I'll help people out. I'll just tell them who to get in touch with. Or, you know, I'll help them book a show. But I don't really book constantly. That's something more what Lena does on a more periodic basis. For me, I'm really just focused on the once a year big fest thing now.
Can you just quickly say a little bit more about what Buddy Fest is?
I guess this is the 9th year, and it's just a noise fest. It started at my house in New Paltz. It's a 2-day thing, like Friday night, Saturday, all day. It's usually about 40 to 50 different performers all about 10 or 15 minute long sets. And we raise money. The past few years, I've been donating the money to Ulster County Canines. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's a nonprofit dog rescue organization in Saugerties. And they do amazing stuff. They just say they rescue dogs. And I love my dog. And I did get two puppies there last year. And they do a ton of fundraising. It's a nonprofit. So, like, doing a noise fest, it's hard to actually raise enough money. I can't really pay everybody $100. So whatever money I do make past my expenses goes to them. And it's been a pretty decent amount the past few years. And it keeps growing. Even now, still getting bigger.
And Lena, I know you've mentioned a couple of times your traditional dance background, and I know that you teach ballet in Kingston, right? And so I just was curious to hear a little bit about, how you ended up encountering this kind of postmodern performance, and was there some performance that you saw, like, amid your more traditional training that turned you on to more experimental work?
I'm lucky in that, parallel to my ballet training and, you know, classical modern dance training, I was lucky to have been working in classes with a woman in New York City named Ellen Robbins. She does something pretty radical, which is she lets kids as young as 5 create their own dances and perform them. So I think, like, from the jump as a kid, being able to create my own work kind of laid the groundwork for this stuff. And I always was kind of like walking this balance between this, like, classical dance world and a more kind of like experimental dance world. But I would say, I don't know, probably sometime in college, I got bored, maybe, or disillusioned. And I started this dance series that I still do today called Bad Dance. And I asked for all my friends and everybody I knew in the dance conservatory. I went to SUNY Purchase to make, like, the worst work they could possibly make, or just the most, like, it's not completed, it's not thought out, or it's, you know, obscene. And I would say that was kind of like my radicalization moment, was just seeing my peers, like, pull out this amazing work, and, like, what freedom it gives people when you allow them to be bad. It actually turns out really good most of the time.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask about, like, you you mentioned that you're getting close to retiring the LED light element in your work because you've used it so much. When I first saw you two perform at North Node, it stood out. I'd never seen that kind of technology. You had LED lights that were attached to your fingernails, and then there was something going on that I still don't really understand. It looked like a light that was just floating. And it's very beautiful. And that's a very distinctive element in what I know of your performances. So I just wanted to ask you, why light?
I think the way my process kind of works is I get these compulsions, and then I order a lot of things on the internet and play with them. So one of the things that it was the lights, one of those things. And, I didn't start out from a place of thinking, oh, this is a really beautiful tool. I was just like, what is this? And I got curious and started playing. And then it turned into this thing that felt so emotional and symbolic and, you know, really like blossomed into all of these meanings for me. But it didn't start out that way. And the process is very unglamorous. It's kind of hilarious. These lights are, so they're battery powered. So you have to turn them on one by one. And I'll use hundreds of them in a performance. So it's quite time consuming to turn them on. And, you know, sometimes after shows, I'll turn them off one by one or, I don't know. It's kind of a humbling process. During the piece I did in January, that was like the bigger dance piece I made. I had these very lovely teenagers helping me turn on these hundreds and hundreds of lights. And, one of them was like, you know, you seem really, really nice, but this is insane. And I was like, that's probably the highest compliment I could get from a teenager. So,
So I imagine, like, if you buy these things on impulse to play with, I imagine there must be a lot of like discarded Amazon or whatever items that could have been a part of a prop in a dance performance and didn't work out.
Yeah. I have a little part of my house that I use as my studio, and it's just like a junkyard. But it's funny because I try never to throw stuff out, because sometimes I'll pick something up later and then end up getting inspired by it. So I kind of try to keep my like junkyard intact.
And I know that you've written a manifesto about light, and we just have a couple minutes left. So I was wondering if to close, I can ask you to read it.
This is my Light Meditations manifesto. My Light Meditation series was a number of dances using live sound, projections, costumes, and props with lights. Exhume visual stimuli from moving bodies that would lie dormant without the support of specially designed garments and lighting design. Use visual language to guide the audience's focus. By taking away light and adding it back sparingly, we may more easily engage with symbolism and meaning in choreography. Give audiences the opportunity to see dimensions and details of movement we would miss if seen among a denser landscape of visual elements. Amplify a dancer's ability to scatter and project their unique energetic makeup, expanding the visual and oral impact of a moving body. Help us better understand our essences, the root of momentum in our bodies, and what we are fascinated with in the invisible forces within and among moving bodies. Heal the traumas of being unheard, unseen, or misunderstood based on our external appearances. Use light, costume, and sound to communicate what is true within the felt experiences of our body.
To wrap things up, I just wanted to ask you too about what you have coming up. Do you have any upcoming shows that you want to mention?
I do. On the 25th, I'm playing at the Old Dutch Church in Kingston for Drone Day. A bunch of other great people are playing. Lucas Brody, Damian Patrick, Clary, someone else, others. That's a really cool one. And then I'm doing some fests later in the summer. Don't have a ton of local things going on at the moment, but Northeast Noise Fest is one that I've been doing. It's in Worcester, Massachusetts. And another one in Rochester in October. This guy, Adam Aratola, does this experimental week. It's a week of shows in different venues. And that's about it. Trying to focus on hanging with the dogs, you know, hanging out with Lena, just doing like kind of normal stuff. And I don't really have any tours or anything coming up, and kind of focused on just like recording and putting out music and just living at the moment.
And when is Buddy Fest this year?
It's July 19th and 20th. Is my dog's turning 11.
Okay. Does it always coincide with your dog's birthday?
Yeah. The way that I started the fest was my friend and I were on tour about 10 years ago, and we were playing all these fests with these cool names. It's kind of goes back to like this anti-aesthetic that all the fests had, like really nice. End Times is awesome. It's a really cool name. But I didn't really think I could compete with all those people. I didn't want to. I just wanted to make it the fest be specific to the shows that we had at my house and be kind of like the opposite and have it be like about cuteness. And just everybody's so happy. You know, it's harsh noise and everything, but the people aren't really harsh at all. There's a lot of love involved. And that was really the whole thing behind it and what keeps it going. You know, everybody loves my dog.
I have a Momenta show at Transpicos in Ridgewood, Queens that I co-curated and co-produced with my co-producer Lena Deutsch on May 26th, Sunday, May 26th. I'm performing at a farm in Rockaway Beach on August 4th. That's curated by an amazing artist based in the Rockaways named Mika. And hopefully, if I can, I'll be participating in Raw Dances Salon on August 2nd and 3rd in Kingston. They're a really wonderful organization that is based in the Hudson Valley in San Francisco.
Well, Lena and Matt, it was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for sitting down with me today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.